Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey everyone, this is Radio Motherboard. Today we are going to be talking about copyright. I'm Jason Kebler, I'm a staff writer here. I have Adrian.
Hello.
Sarah.
Hi.
And Parker.
Hi.
Parker and Sarah are both guests. I'm going to let them kind of introduce themselves and you know, tell us why they're here.
So Sarah and I write a copyright newsletter that has jokes in it called Five Useful Articles.
Why is it called Five Useful Articles?
Useful Articles is itself a copyright joke. We named it before we knew that like people were gonna subscribe to it.
This is an excellent newsletter, by the way.
Yeah,
I highly recommend.
The feedback we get, and I don't wanna toot our own horn here, is that like people think it's a lot more interesting and funny than they expected copyright could be. So
that's why I wanted to do a podcast about copyright, because you think piracy kind of interesting, it gets a lot of attention, but everything else, you know, sounds kind of boring, but it's not boring at all. And why is it not boring?
Copyright is a train wreck. That's what's great about it. It is basically, you've got a law that in the 70s it was already kind of not perfect for the situation, and then now it's just a disaster. It's great.
It's like an absurdist, like dystopian nightmare. It's so over the top.
It's also really funny because you get like a lot of characters. So like the kinds of people who really care about copyright sometimes are just like really odd characters. So and then, you know, what's great is like you also get like musicians, celebrities, artists, just like an incredible like revolving cast of characters.
That is a funny thing about doing. So since we do the newsletter, I follow copyright news like really closely. And the story, I mean, the people that you get in the stories, it's not people in suits. It's like you get, everything has an information aspect to it. And like the legal way that you interact with information is through copyright. And so like, you know, on a given week, we'll do a picture do they make a fair use of the picture, and what the subject of the photo will be something really interesting. And so there's this weird angle where that's not technically part of the story, but the fact that it's something unusual is just, it gives color to it.
I can think of like 5 really interesting like copyright cases off the top of my head just from the last year. You have that monkey who took a picture of himself.
Yep.
That's a weird one. That's a really weird one.
Yes, we won't get too far into it right now, but basically there was a photographer who had set up a camera in the jungle, and the monkey took the photo, basically.
And that, I think that really demonstrates why the law is so weird, because it all turns on like things that, you know, to a normal human being shouldn't matter. Like, okay, where were his hands at the time? Like, was the photographer? We call him the photographer, but like, did he press the button? And it's like, oh, well, the outcome of, you know, all of these business decisions, like whether the news agency goes after people or Wikipedia has to take the photo down, it all depends on something that seems totally arbitrary, like whose finger was closest to the button at the time that, and so you have these weird things, and like, and on one hand, it's very rule based, and you look and you're like, okay, that's internally consistent, but on the other hand, it's like, and we make decisions based on this, based on what you know, a group of lawyers said in the 70s?
I mean, millions of dollars are, like, change hands due to things like this, right?
Yeah, yeah. And you have, like, I mean, this is, there are those weird cases, but then there are, like, you know, music copyright cases where we're talking about tens of millions of dollars at stake. And that's, and it's still, it's not by any logic that's any more sound than the weird, you know, monkey finger press.
Mm-hmm.
It's still just weird decision-making processes.
Right.
Yeah, it doesn't seem any closer to a solution. I wanted to just, like, test the sound here, because we're in this kind of, like, bootleg setup here in the office today.
Is it working?
I guess we have to talk, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It works great. Okay, good.
Perfect.
Awesome.
Adrian can hear us. So to get into, like, I guess we can't cover all of copyright law in this podcast, or
sadly.
Or can we?
How long do you have?
How fast are we allowed to talk?
We can talk.
This is the first 28-hour motherboard podcast, and it's just us speaking uninterrupted.
Yes, you should pee now, maybe grab something to eat, and then strap in. No, but there was a very weird case a couple weeks ago that Parker, I think, will love to talk about. SpaceX flew a NASA satellite into orbit. NASA paid SpaceX to do it, and SpaceX published photos from it. And whose photos are those? I mean, we paid for, we being the taxpayers of the United States, paid for that mission, but SpaceX is a private company and they took the photos. So why does this matter, and, like, why should we care?
Yeah, again, it's one of those distinctions that seems arbitrary, where if you are an employee of the federal government, like, you've got an employment contract, then everything that you do in the course of your work is in the public domain, and that, you know, completely unrestricted. And we don't talk about the public domain too often, but it's you know, no restrictions, and that's how it is with most NASA photos, is that you can use them for literally whatever you want. And you know, as a nerd, I like to, I saw an old ad the other day, and the ad set was for a chocolate bar, and so the chocolate bar is out of this world, and it had a picture of, you know, of space. It's out of this world, and it was a NASA photo, and they didn't have to clear that or anything. It's just, and yeah. But if you've got a contract, if you're not an employee, then it's not public domain necessarily. And so it's just this weird thing where we sort of lucked into every photo that's of space happens to be accessible to everyone, except now maybe it won't be. And you know, maybe it, if for each photo, it may not matter that much. But this fact that we've had this resource of basically all the pictures of the Earth collectively are freely accessible, and that could go away. And so it's these weird things where the other kind of weird copyright thing is that the terms are really, really long. It'll last for 95 years if SpaceX has copyright. So it's a decision that you know, they're doing rocket science. Like, they're doing a lot of hard things, and so they shouldn't have to think about the copyright on the photos. But it's a decision that will matter, you know, 8 decades from now. And we'll have to, you know, presumably Sarah and I will still be writing the newsletter. We might even still be recording this podcast. And
you'll be listening.
And someone will have to piece together, okay, which spacecraft was the camera on? Like, yeah. What did the contract say between them? And, you know, what, like, who pressed, was the camera, like, automatically taking photos, or was it, you know, was somebody pressing a button on Earth? And these sorts of things that shouldn't matter, like, could ultimately decide important things.
I think that's, like, the general takeaway here, is that copyright is, like, really, really confusing, and it's, like, kind of case by case. There's lots goes into it, and if you don't know, you could be liable. You could end up, you know, losing a lot of money.
Yeah, and this is actually, like, a serious problem. So, like, the NASA, like, space photos thing is kind of, like, you know, it's a photogenic issue, because you understand space photographs. And, like, I'm glad that it's gotten pickup and people are talking about it, but this has been, like, a problem that's existed for, like, a long time. You know, anything that's a federal work isn't subject to copyright. But because you have, like, a lot more, like, contractors and stuff now, it totally, now that whole status depends on the contract between, like, the contractor and the U.S. government, and that we're not privy to the contents of those contracts. And so you have basically all these research papers and just, you know, long manuals and things like that that were produced by contractors, and we don't, and but they're like federal resources. There's stuff about, like, you know, marshlands and, like, yeah, no, like the Department of Energy. So, like, the impact of, like, of, like, wind energy on, like, this area. Like, so it's all stuff that the federal government is putting out, but they're putting it out through a contractor's labor. So you don't know what the copyright status on that is. And actually, like, if you go and, like, you try to clear it with the government, no one knows.
Yeah.
Like, and, in a lot of cases. So it's, like, it's actually, like, this is, like, a problem.
And to speak to Jason's point, the other thing that happened is that the penalties for infringing copyright got ratcheted way up. So it's, you know, it can be $150,000 per work that you infringe. And so, like, again, you have to talk about a century of what are you going to do with this. And it's like the manual for the space shuttle. Like, if we don't know, then maybe you don't archive it, because it could cost you, you know, $150,000. Or if there are three editions, it could be $500,000. And so no one archives it, and then it just disappears. And that sort of thing is, like...
Yeah. The thing that is crazy to me is that it's no longer clear whose interests are being served by these laws. Like, it's kind of serving the interests of...
It's this runaway thing.
I mean, sometimes it serves, like, the interests of, like, the record industry and, like, the movie industry, and sometimes it's, like, obvious like that, but it's, at this point, it's like a beast, right? Like, it's it's biting the hand that fed it, and it's kind of, it's out of control.
So, I mean, why are the laws so confusing? Is it because you have these different interests throughout time and you kind of have, like, piecemeal solutions to, like, specific problems that can then be extrapolated, like, very broadly? Or is it just...
Yeah, well, you have a lot of things where really, like, you look at this section of the law and you go, like, that seems to make very little sense. And then, yeah, you can trace it back and you go, like, oh, there was one person in the room when they were discussing this who, like, lobbied for that because he or she had one client that needed that. And that, like, affects, you know, maybe in the 70s this affected, you know, whoever copies things, which was hard to do in the 70s. But now it's like everybody who uses a computer has to deal with the fallout of that one guy's client, like, requesting such and such. And with this law, you never have the people who, like, it's never been the case that you have, like, the internet users and the people who and now have to interact with copyright all the time in the room at all. So it's like this weird corporate law. It's like finance law or something where it's supposed to affect a handful of major players applied to everybody. And it's as if, you know, like, I mean, I don't think this would be funny, but if we had to all follow, like, you know, Sarbanes-Oxley, like banking laws for ourselves, for, like, you know, should we split dinner right now? And it's like, oh, well, we have to fill out the forms in triplicate. And that wouldn't stand, but for some reason, that's what we have with copyright.
So is there hope here? I mean, is there copyright reform? You don't really hear much about it. You hear always about the court cases. You know, there's this blurred lines thing going on right now, which I won't get into, but... What's going to happen? Anything? I mean, is it continue being a mess?
Well, they talk about reform, and they, I mean, you know, it's like I think about the last major reform getting passed in 76, and it's like, wow, that must have been, it took them like decades to actually get done. And our Congress right now does nothing. Like, we can't, you know, you can't, like, name a bridge through Congress, like, because they just, like, disagree on everything. And so, yeah, there's an effort. They have this thing that they trot out called the Next Great Copyright Act, where they've been holding hearings in the House for 2 years now. And they hold a hearing and they get everyone in a room and say that piracy's bad. And then, like, in...
This sounds scary.
Yeah, no, it would be scary if it were not, like, so excruciatingly boring. And this
boring
is...
and obviously bound to go nowhere. Like,
yeah.
It would be scary if it weren't all kind of... You know, a little silly. It's a little silly.
But then it's this boring thing that really does have an effect on, like, what we're allowed to do and how we use, you know, our computers and the internet.
I mean, like, if the Next Great Copyright Act actually ever happens, and, you know, some people some people actually do think that, like, the next Great Copyright Act sort of derailed earnest copyright reform efforts, because suddenly, you know, all these people were on the same page about a couple things. Like, you know, it was immediately after Aaron Swartz passed away, and people were talking about, like, the DMCA exemption for cell phones. So, like, there was suddenly, it was, copyright reform was much more like.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
In the news, and people were thinking about it again, and then they trot out the next Great Copyright Act, which is like 500 things, which, like, you know, and a lot of them people just are, I don't care about this. This is like reforming music licensing, like, yeah, like, which is really interesting, but maybe, like, not as interesting as, like, is it illegal to jailbreak your phone? Like, yeah.
Yeah, I feel like maybe when we talk about how boring copyright reform is, we undersell that. I promise the newsletter is funny. Like, there is actually a good way to talk about this, but it's not the way politicians do.
If you're possibly, like, trying to make the issue boring, there's a way to make it boring. Like, it's like, you know, and then at this point, then you get people saying, like, that there's something sinister going on, which I don't know if that's necessarily true, but the way things have played out, that's what people are jumping to now.
Right. Like, well, it's just sort of all-encompassing. So there's certainly very boring, like, procedural parts to it. And then there's, like, space. Who owns this?
Yeah.
And, like, you know, can Robin Thicke, like, sample this song or apologize if I got that, like, that case wrong? I did not read the details of it.
That's basically right. Yeah. Not sample, but...
No, it's not. It's
too similar.
Can
you make a song that sounds like
Marvin Gaye? Yeah.
When we cut the podcast, we have to cut in some of the clips.
Some blurred lines.
Just blurred lines, and then see what happens with copyright. So I think one thing that's clear about copyright is that besides Sarah Parker, people just don't really understand how to interpret it. Like, for example, this story that you did this week about Citizen 4. And I don't know if this was a genuine misunderstanding or not, but there was a court case, and do you want to just kind of...
Yes, it's a very insane court case on many levels. There is a guy in Kansas who's a retired naval officer who decided to sue Edward Snowden and Laura Poitras, who made Citizen 4, trying to prevent the release of Citizen 4 because it contains classified information. And so he sued not only to stop the film from being released after it was already released, he also asked for billions of dollars for the US government to make up for everything that Snowden leaked, all the harms from that. And in trying to stop the film from being released, Laura Poitras then entered two copies of the film as evidence.
DVDs of the film.
DVDs of the film, yes. She actually delivered copies of the film to the lawyer, the plaintiff's lawyer, who then said that she didn't watch it, she locked it away in her room, in her office, and that it remains there unwatched. Meanwhile, it's in over 150 theaters. It's, you know, this was a few weeks before the Oscars, but it was nominated for an Oscar. It was screened on HBO. It's everywhere.
As if, and the lawyer's acting like it's The Room, and you know, if she watches it, she'll 7 days, and like,
yeah, it's an extremely fun court case.
Yeah,
the trees come crawling out of the television.
Yeah.
But the copyright issue at hand here is there's a website called Cryptome. I think that's how you say it.
Yeah.
There's a website called Cryptome, and after it was entered as evidence, they basically posted a link to Citizen 4 to download it, saying, it's entered as evidence in a federal case. It's now public domain, meaning anyone can do anything with it. This is not accurate. correct?
Yeah. No, that's not accurate. I mean, like, if you think about it, blurred lines is evidence in the blurred lines case. That doesn't mean blurred lines is now out of copyright. Actually, Stuart Baker, formerly of the NSA, filed his own affidavit in this very misguided case about Citizen Four, and as part of his affidavit, he has a bunch of like copies of like articles that he's written, like for the Washington Post, and it's not like that's out of copyright now. And I think one of the things that like Cryptome misunderstood is that Cryptome was like, oh, Laura Poitras wanted this sealed, but the judge wouldn't seal it, so that now it's in the public domain. But it was in fact the other way around. Laura Poitras entered it into evidence and didn't care whether or not it was sealed, because it's like, she's like, it's my movie, there's nothing wrong with this movie. And then the other side is like, no, it has to be under seal, it's like, it's full of state secrets and we can't possibly like have this just out there as an exhibit. And but yeah, the judge was like not having that.
So wait, so she entered it into evidence, or the plaintiff's not?
Sorry, Laura Poitras' defendants entered as evidence.
Okay, so what is the public domain? When do things become public domain?
Well, so like,
when does Citizen Four become public domain?
So very, very, very long time.
So it happens after Laura Poitras dies.
Well, unless it so the answer to this is it depends.
Yes, yeah. It depends on the contracts. So movies are really like kind of difficult, because if you think about it, there's a lot of creators involved in a movie. So so for instance, like a book, if it's written by one person, there's only one creator. So like it's kind of obvious where the copyright automatically goes, and then from there you trace whether it was transferred or whether the author was like working for someone else while doing it. But then with a movie, you've got like you've got just a lot of copyrighted material coming together all at once. So usually you want your contracts all airtight. But we're assuming it's copyright Laura Poitras.
Yeah, I mean, the short answer to this is that it's like probably a century from now or something like that, mm-hmm. that this will be in the public domain. And that is like the way that the law has also changed in the last like century. And so so like nothing enters the public domain right now because the copyright terms have been extended like through now. It's easier to see if you've got like a diagram that shows. But the short answer, I promised a short answer and then I did not deliver a short answer. It's really weird and confusing. And so the truth is like it will enter eventually, maybe. And it almost certainly will not be through being entered as evidence. I would kind of, there's part of me that would like a public domain film to win an Oscar. I think like that would be a nice gesture, but I don't think it happened this year.
Yeah. So interesting question about that. I spoke to one lawyer and he said, no, you can't download Citizen Four now and watch it and think that it's cool. But can you now download Citizen Four, watch it, then write a friend of the court like memorandum and file it in that case and say that you downloaded it for like legal analysis reasons?
I mean, like, you're probably better off renting it. But
there's no legal advice.
Yeah, this is not
right.
This is not legal advice. Yes. We're not. No one.
Yeah, I mean, if you maybe
there was the Motherboard podcast for your
legal advice. I wouldn't do it. That's like, I love fair use, but this is like. I wouldn't go to bat for this. Like, this is not.
There was a case where a guy made a documentary about the film rating system that the MPAA, which is just, you know, like the movie industry group, voluntarily runs the rating system. It's not a government thing or anything. And he submitted a copy of the. He was very critical, and the process is very secretive. And he submitted a copy of the film to get rated, to see what they did. And he got a call the next day from someone in he sent it to the Hollywood office, and someone in the DC office called him and they said, I've just watched your film. He said, wait, how have you watched my film? And he said, yeah, well, I mean, we you sent it to the Hollywood office and we made a copy and they've got a very good business reason to do this, right? They're doing it for the film. But the guy was, the director was like, that's not, you can't do, like, you're the MPAA, you can't infringe my copyright like that. And I think in that case, he was, you know, making a point and saying, like, look at how hypocritical the MPAA is. I think the same kind of principle holds where, like, oh, maybe there's a case for it, but, like, you're probably better off. I think it's on HBO tomorrow, right? Like, just watch it there.
I believe it's on Monday,
yeah.
But probably, yeah, it's probably playing a few times. But, I mean, the fact that we can kind of even have this discussion and that it's not clear, you know, there's fair use. There's all these different reasons that you can use a copyrighted work for your own purposes. That's one of the reasons why it's so interesting, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And there's, and like, so writing, watching the film and writing a brief is sort of a hard call, but you can imagine if you did a project that was like analyzing the time between docket filings in across mm-hmm. many cases. And so you had to download all of the dockets to see, you know, some kind of research project. Where that is like, that would be an easier thing to defend as fair use.
It would be much easier to defend as fair use. I mean, I'm actually having a funny like flashback to the Google Books litigation at the trust, where actually the attorneys were in like a depot together. Like this is in the discovery phase. And the attorneys for the Authors Guild, and they're the ones who were suing over the copyright and all these books that were scanned during the Google Books scanning project, and the attorneys who are like, you know, mad about the books getting scanned bring in these copies of this book, like photocopies of someone's book as like evidence, like in discovery, and they're like gonna pass them out, and then the other side gets like really snippy with them and is like, are these photocopies of a book that is in copyright that is currently available in bookstores for sale? And then they get into like this argument where they're like sort of dancing around the question of whether or not they just infringed copyright and whether it's fair use to scan a book, right? I mean, it was like, it's, you know, in the course of litigation, you want to like pass information around and right, like, but like obviously because of the side that they had taken and the arguments that they had made, now they were in like this really embarrassing position. They were like, okay, fine, we're gonna take these copies, we're gonna take them to the shredder, we're gonna shred them, and we won't have looked at them. Is everyone happy with that? And then like, and then the other side is like, so you're saying if no one looks at it that it's not copyright infringement? And but that was actually that was their argument in the case, because they had like scanned these books, but they hadn't made the whole book available. And the Authors Guild was saying, like, well, you still scanned the whole book. So that's, it's still, you know, it's still infringement, like, of the whole book. And, yeah, no, it was really, like, this beautiful, ironic moment. But, yeah.
I mean, it's just...
I mean, they didn't... It just was just, like, a snippy argument. It's, like, buried in the transcripts. Like, they just got into the snippy little argument and then...
almost all the book scanning cases,
yeah.
The book scanners win. That is over and over found to be fair use, even though it's... I mean,
it takes
this weird
a long
thing.
Time. That's the thing. Like, if Google had chosen not to... If the book scanners had chosen not to fight it, like, this would, like, have... Yeah, like we might just have some really terrible precedent on our hands just because, like, it was a lot of effort. Like they were like, they wanted to go to the mattresses over this.
Yeah, I mean, it's like it's sort of like the rocket science question where it's, you know, Google endeavors to do this thing where they scan million, you know, they go into hundreds of libraries and scan millions of books and put all of them on, you know, this really complex thing. And the thing that might stop them is a law from the 70s. And it's like, oh, yeah, I guess you have to. And then you're like into the sub clauses and you're trying to find out whether like you can convince one judge that they're on the right side of the law. It's just this weird. It seems like a weird impediment to something that, and actually in Google Books, that's ultimately what the judge said, is like, this is such an amazing resource. Mm-hmm. How could it be that a law that's designed to, you know, promote the progress of science and useful arts would prohibit this, and it doesn't.
Okay, well, we're kind of running out of time here. I know we promised like 12 hours worth of copyright talk, but we unfortunately don't have the room that long. But trust us, we could talk that long if we wanted to. Anyways, we may explore some more copyright in the future, but I just want to thank everyone for listening and everyone for being here. This was very fun.
Thank you guys so much for coming.
Thank you guys. Thank you.
Yes. Until next time, which hopefully will be next week and not like a month from now, like this one took, but goodbye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Your personal info, like addresses, phone numbers, and more, are collected and sold by data brokers. But Aura steps in, scanning the web, sending you alerts, and requesting your info be removed. Get Aura's full toolkit, including credit and transaction monitoring, a password manager, VPN, and more. Get a 14-day free trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety.